This evening, I talk with Kristen Schedule, whose book, Losing the Way, is about to be published on June 25th, 2008. We have a discussion about her life, the ups and downs, the good, the bad. I hope you enjoy the interview. Now, the day that we're taping this, your book is a little over 2 weeks from release. What goes through an author's mind at this time?
What goes through my mind? Well, excitement and trepidation. It's kind of like having a baby for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what to expect quite, but you know it's going to change your life.
Right.
In some way. I mean, maybe not dramatically, but it's going to, things are not going to be quite the same as they were before. At least that's what other authors have told me. So I'm excited.
So now the book is about you and your experiences. So tonight we'll delve into your life and what led you to write the book.
Okay.
I guess the first question is, why did you write the book?
Well, a couple of reasons. First off, it was really to find meaning and healing in what had happened. I was so confused when I got out of the way, and I couldn't make sense of the trauma. Writing has been a really effective tool for people that have been abused to make sense of what happened to them, because they literally put into words what was unspeakable before. And it allowed me to open the lockbox that Orwell had sworn me to secrecy, to keep closed. So healing was one thing. And also I wanted to really reach out to people that were still in cults, or that had been in the way, that were still kind of under that shroud of silence, and try to give them a voice, and to give people that had no idea about cults a way to feel what it was like to be in a cult. That's my biggest hope for the book, is that, yeah, to people that haven't had the opportunity to speak about what happened to them, or that had been too afraid or too intimidated to say that, you know, to bear witness to what happened, and to kind of connect with people that have been through similar things that are in cults. I remember thinking, or even going into bookstores when I was still in the way, looking for a book that would speak to my experience, and there just weren't any out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if I would have bought it at the time, but I think I was really searching for something to help me make sense of what was happening to me with the abuse. And so that was another reason why I wrote it, was to reach out to people that are in abusive situations, and also to help people that aren't in cults, or, you know, that wonder, how on earth did somebody like you get involved in something like that? We've all heard that question.
Mm-hmm.
To kind of answer that, not in a didactic way, but in a more, in a way that they'd feel it in their gut, that they'd experience what it's like to be in the way, or to be in a cult.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I wrote it in the first person, in the present tense, so that it was very immediate, and people kind of, you know, it's in your face and you're going through it, you are there kind of thing. And that's my hope, that it's not just a how-to book of how to get out of a cult or how to get into a cult,
mm-hmm.
but really just to help people feel it and understand it on a emotional level.
Yeah, it hasn't really been done, at least, you know, particularly with the way.
Yeah.
And so what do you think it will accomplish?
What will it accomplish? Well, what I'm hoping it will accomplish is that it may refute some stereotypes about people that get involved in cults.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of the typical street person that doesn't have any place to go, and they get sucked into this group, and they dress up in saffron robes and sell carnations in the airport type thing. It's really, you know, looking at the kids that get involved, or the old people that get involved, that are really accomplished and idealistic people that are looking for answers to questions that have been plaguing them. So I hope to show that it's not, that it can be the kid next door, mm-hmm. or that it could be you, it could be any of us, that it's, that none of us are immune to being duped. And I think that's the power and the tragedy of a cult, is that it starts out being so good and too good to be true, and people go down the garden path and are really just led astray. And so I hope to show people that it could be any of us, and that it's not something that you have to, you know, be a street person or have a low IQ to get involved with one of these.
Right.
It's, you know, this stuff happens. And also hoping to increase people's empathy for people that are in cults, with that Texas polygamy cult that's been in the news recently.
Right.
So many people have come up to me and said, you know, how do these women, how do they live like this? How do they manage, or how can they have all these children and not know who the parents are or who the mother is, and live in this kind of strict, rigid environment? And to kind of help them understand and empathize with these women, that they're human beings and that they've just been, that they're in a very rigid system that doesn't allow them to question. And we, as people that were in the way or in a cult, end up not having having the capacity to think for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I just hope to shed light on that in my book. And that would be a dream come true if I could accomplish that, to create empathy for people that are in cults.
I think it's going to do that, too. I really do.
I hope so.
Let's go into your life when you were in the, you talk about the rigid constraints of a cult mentality.
Uh-huh.
You were involved in it from very early age, and then at one point you got married. Do you want to talk a little bit about your marriage?
Sure. Yeah, it was, we were in the Way Corps, and it was, my former husband just walked up to me one day and said God told him that he was going to marry me, and so I didn't have much to say in the matter, although I said I did have a lot to say in the matter, and we went back and forth for quite a bit, and, but when I went to see Dr. Warwell, he said, no, this is the right thing, and you should marry this guy, and so he gave me the blessing, even though I had a lot of doubts about it. I went ahead, and it's one of those crazy things. I mean, I have two children from that union, and so I wouldn't trade them for the world, but it was a very difficult experience.
No, it was an abusive situation also, wasn't it?
Yeah. Before we'd even gotten married, he broke my arm. Not in a rage or anything, but we were just quote unquote fooling around, and he was getting pretty rough, and I was trying to get him to stop, and he just persisted, and I held up my arm to block his whatever you want to call it, assailing, and he went right across my arm and it broke.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked around for a week with a broken arm. Now this is kind of crazy, but because I said I think something broke, and he was like, oh, you're crazy, you know, you can move your fingers and nothing's broken. And so I said, oh, okay, nothing's broken, you're the man of God, so I'll listen to you. And it just shows how completely dependent and taken over I was at that point, because the man of God was, I'd made my husband into being my leader,
mm-hmm.
and stopped thinking for myself, even to the point where with a broken bone in my body, I didn't go to get help. And I'll never forget when I went to, finally, after a week of my arm just hanging off of my shoulder, I went to a doctor and he put a cast on it and he said, look, I'll save these x-rays for you for 7 years in case you need them. And I was like, well, why on earth would I need them?
Huh.
And what he was saying to me was, you know, this was abuse. This was not an accident. And so I never went back to the doctor to get the films. But
mm-hmm.
This was just kind of the handwriting on the wall. I mean, I don't look at my ex-husband as an evil person in the sense that Dr. Worwell was, where Dr. Worwell knowingly did what he did and used people. I think my ex-husband was just as much a victim
mm-hmm.
as I was. He just didn't have very good anger management skills
right.
at the time. So once I got into the marriage, it became clear that this was, you know, he really used physical intimidation and abuse as a way of controlling me and as a way of letting off steam himself, because he didn't know any other way.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But now that was not all that uncommon with marriages in the way.
No. I remember one incident where we had a really horrible fight, and I called the branch leader, and this was out in Oregon, and they came and picked me up because I was so bruised and shaken up. And when I was there, I heard somebody else calling on the phone, and I overheard them talking to this individual and talking her down and saying, you know, he didn't mean to do it, and you have to, you know, submit to him, and he shouldn't be hitting you, but, you know, just saying the same things to them, to her, that they said to me. And they brought my ex-husband in to talk with him and me, and the upshot of it was that he's the leader and he shouldn't do this, because husbands should cherish their wives as Christ loved the church.
Mm-hmm.
But wives should also respect their husbands and not talk back and not have a mind of their own. So in spite of myself, I kept trying to assert myself. So that got me into some trouble, I guess. But it wasn't the wrong thing to do. It was certainly just misguided. And a lot of fundamentalist women that are in fundamentalist marriages get this really mixed up of what it means to submit and what it means the men to, as Christ loved the church, because Christ certainly didn't go around beating people.
Right.
And in terms of respect is something that's earned. And so there just has to be a very clear line that physical abuse is not acceptable in any kind of a relationship. It's just not a means of effective communication.
Right.
And we didn't learn anger management skills in the way. We didn't learn how to even express disagreement. Or I didn't, anyway. I just didn't, in our Christian motivational techniques, that wasn't one of the skills that I learned.
Right. Now, throughout your marriage, that led to depression and also to the point of suicidal thoughts.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that?
Well, yeah, I didn't see any way out. It paints a really vivid picture of what it was like in the mindset of the cult, that it was either all or nothing, black or white. You were either in the way, you were in the core, or you weren't. And if you got a divorce, it was not God's will, and you might as well, you know, be a grease spot on the highway of life, right? And I just thought it was better to kill myself than to betray what the teaching that I'd had, because I just felt like I wasn't living up to it. And it was really a set of circumstances that saved me, that were kind of fortuitous, very fortuitous, and helped me start to understand that there was a gray area in there, that it wasn't just all or nothing thinking. I learned about cognitive distortions and how the mind can take things that are of degrees and turn them into the extreme.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, you know, just because my marriage wasn't working didn't mean that I needed to die. Just because I wasn't living up to the core standard didn't mean that I needed to take my own life or the lives of my children or the lives of anybody else. It was really just about living up to the standard of doing the best I could do. And I didn't understand that at the time. So I became very, very all or nothing in my thinking.
Mm-hmm. I know I've had those insidious thoughts throughout my life at different times, and it's just an incredibly lonely place to be, because there's no way to reach out. There's no way to communicate that with somebody.
Right.
When you were at these moments, This was over what kind of a period of time?
Oh, gosh. This was, I'd say it went on for several years.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe three years. And I went to Dr. Worwell with, you know, I told him that I was suicidal and I wanted to take my own life, and I couldn't. I actually flew in an airplane to see him. I hitched a ride on one of those puddle jumpers in Colorado.
Oh, yeah.
And I went to see him in Camp Gunnison, and I was completely distraught. And I remember as I was in the airplane, I was thinking, well, what would happen if I opened the door and just jumped out? You know, that would really screw up the airplane and everybody else, so I better not do that. But when I got there, he just told me that I was possessed, and then he had sex with me. So that was a mind blower.
Yeah.
You know, not only was I feeling completely isolated and alone, but I was possessed, and he was showing me God's way out, quote unquote.
Oh, I remember reading that, and I just was like, this is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I as far as I was concerned, I thought that the VP was a misogynist.
Right.
Yeah, because he just, you know, he didn't think outside himself. He was all right. For himself.
Ultimate narcissist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Describe a little bit about what was going on inside you, particularly after the incident with VP. I mean, that just must have complicated and multiplied the feelings inside.
Yeah. Well, my mind was really tricky, because I had a staggering capacity for denial. And so when he told me that it was a devil spirit that was causing me to feel this way, and I'd better shape up or we'd never have any more times together, I thought, oh my God, I need to see Dr. Worwell. I need the man of God. I can't, you know, that was tantamount to being thrown out of God's presence. If he abandoned me, then then I was totally alone. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, I'm gonna shape up. I'm not gonna think this way, even though the thoughts persisted and the depression persisted. I went back to my husband, and he knew I was depressed, but I don't know how aware he was of what was going on, and certainly at the time I didn't tell him what had happened. So I just forced myself to fit into this little vise of corruption.
Mm-hmm.
And it made things worse, but I just denied that was happening inside of me.
But it must have made the, for lack of a better term, the battle inside worse. I mean,
oh, sure.
You know, you talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think, like in my own practice, I deal with people that are depressed and have chronic feelings of suicidal ideation. And when you're in a depression, that's an actual illness. And so you can, no matter what you tell yourself, you still, the chemical imbalances in your mind don't respond to Bible verses necessarily.
Right.
You know, you can tell yourself over and over again, be renewed in the spirit of your mind. But if you're clinically depressed, you really need medication or therapy or some kind of other intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just had, having grown up in the family that I did, in an alcoholic family, I was really skilled at masking my feelings and being a good little soldier. And so I just carried on the best I could.
Mm-hmm.
But I was in total despair. And it really wasn't until, well, I don't want to give the story away, so I won't say anything. We'll leave that as a cliffhanger.
In light of the thing with VP, he obviously led others down this same path.
Uh huh.
Did you have experience of knowing any other people that this had happened to?
No, not at the time.
No. Okay.
But I do recall when I saw him that one time, he had a whole box of rings, sterling silver rings, that he was very excited that I take one. And it was, and several of them were had already been given away. And it made me wonder, well, who else was he giving these rings to? You know, it made me feel very special.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it made me wonder, well, I must not be the only one. And I'd heard of other women that had had committed suicide or had kind of just disappeared from the way mysteriously. And I never put it together that they were involved with Dr. Worwell.
Mm-hmm.
He had a just a breathtaking manner of making you feel like you were the only one and you were special, and being as vulnerable as I was, I needed that, you know, or I thought I needed that. And he was, as far as I was concerned, the only person that could save me.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of God, and he was God's man on earth. So
right.
If I couldn't listen to him who I saw, how was I going to listen to somebody whom I didn't see?
Right.
That kind of thing. So, to answer your question, I really didn't know anyone personally, but as it, you know, as time went on, I started piecing the things together.
During this time, you had, well, eventually you had two children, but you had one child while you were going through all of this.
Right.
How did you manage and cope with that?
It was very, very, very hard. I mean, it was torture. I think I had postpartum depression for one thing, and I had prepartum depression for another thing. But as soon as my son was born, that's when the switch turned on for me, that I realized something wasn't right with everything that I'd heard. And so I started really searching. And so I had some hope, like that maybe things would start to come together for me.
Mm-hmm.
And in my marriage. And but it just got worse and worse.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to the point of, you know, wanting to end everything.
Right. And you guys can read it in the book, what happened.
Oh, darn.
Yeah. I'm really excited about the book. It's like I've had the privilege of being able to read it, and it's marvelous.
Well, thank you.
Why do this now? Is this looking into the past? Is this what's past is past? That's one thing that comes up in a thread. You know, why bring it up now? It was, you know, 20 some odd years ago.
Right. Well, it took me 20 years to recover from it, really. And it took several drafts, and I'd written a couple of fictionalized versions of it, and I think it just was, the timing was right for me. And as I said before, it was all in terms of my healing from the trauma and trying to make sense of the trauma. It's a very common question of, you know, why don't you just get over it? Or why bring up the past? Or why not move on? And those are really common questions for people that don't understand trauma. Because the nature of trauma is that you're literally stuck in this dark space, and you repeat it over and over and over, hoping that maybe you'll finally get it right.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's Freud's compulsion to repeat, in one manner of speaking. But the scientists have, psychologists, Penny Baker is one of them, did some studies on writing and trauma, and they found that people that wrote about what they had been through and connected the feelings of what they'd been feeling when they were going through it and how they felt now actually experienced healing in the trauma. And so when I wrote the book, I hadn't done that up until this version. And I was just... it was like a hairball. I just needed to get it out. And I finally got it out, and it just happens to be 20 years. It could have been 40 years. I mean, when you think about Holocaust victims, not that I'm comparing myself to a Holocaust victim, but people that have been through any kind of trauma, whether it's rape or incest or physical abuse, there's a need to give meaning to that experience, because in trauma, meaning is just stripped away. The nature of trauma is that we don't understand why it happened. It doesn't make sense.
Right.
You know, why should this happen to me? What did I do? Where is God? And those were questions that I had to grapple with for years and years and years, and writing was the way that was the best tool for me to do that.
What would you say to young women that have been in this kind of a situation before, a way to get out? What kind of hope is there for them? Could you speak to me a little bit about that?
Sure. First of all, they have to remember that there is hope, that there is a chance of recovery from something like this, and that's through being able to open up to somebody that you trust, and respect. I went the course of therapy, and I first started psychotherapy, and it took me a long time to get to this part about Dr. Warhol, because for me he was still very revered in my eyes. But I went to a thing called exit counseling, which is a specialized form of therapy that addresses cult mind control. And in that, it was the first time I actually looked at, I said Dr. Warhol's name without the doctor in front of it, and I realized that he was just a man that had used me for his own fulfillment and hadn't really had my best interests at heart at all. And so in the course of exit counseling, there you can find them online through Freedom of Mind Foundation or ICSA, the International Cultic Studies Association. If you go online, they have exit counseling links to them. But exit counseling was really important. Writing, as I said, was really important. And being able to have a safe place where you can talk about what happened and go into detail about what happened without feeling shame about it was tremendously healing for me. And I think that there are many, many resources. I know that there are many resources on the internet for even people that have suffered clergy abuse, people that have had their psychotherapists abuse them. I mean, trust is such a big issue for us because we've been betrayed so deeply, not just spiritually or sexually, but in our deepest core of who we are and what we find sacred or hold sacred. So having somebody that you can trust, and I found that paying somebody to do that was safe because it was an even exchange. You know, I pay you and you sit there and listen to me, and that way I don't owe you anything except this means of exchange. So having somebody that you can trust and take time to build that relationship, it takes time. It takes time to recover, but getting information on the internet, pursuing exit counseling, and having a connection with people that are supportive of you. My family, I was very lucky to have a family that cared about me and was there for me when I needed them. So I hope that gives some sense of hope, and that there are many resources out there for people.
Good. Yeah, we'll put together some links. I'll put them on GreeSpot.
Okay.
Of different things. We'll work on that over the next week or so.
Okay, great.
Could you treat us to a reading from your book?
Sure, I'd love to. Why don't I read the section from a little bit from where I see the doctor when I go down to Colorado.
Okay.
I'm at the coach, at the motor coach, and I walk in and it goes, I walk toward the back, past two neatly made beds. I come to the doctor's door and knock softly. Come on in here, says the gruff voice. I open the door tentatively. The doctor is seated at his desk in a dark blue satin robe. He, too, has put on weight, and his stocky frame fills the gold swivel chair. He's wearing his square aviator glasses, which perch on a bulbous nose. His light brown hair is wet and combed back straight. He also has a perpetual tan. Well, look who's here. You made it, he says. His blue eyes crinkle as he holds out his arms. He has deep, weathered crevices in his face from years of smiling. When I look closely at his face, The topography reminds me of a mountain range. He is not an especially handsome man with his thin lips and rough skin, but his face has the regal character of a figure from Mount Rushmore. He is a president, after all, president and founder of the Way International, the fastest growing ministry in the world. A few tears fall on his shoulder as he hugs me, but I don't say anything. He's used to people crying when they see him, and he doesn't mind. He always knows what to do. He knows that people feel about him the way they feel about Jesus or the Apostle Paul. He is their spiritual leader. I glance down at his desk. It is strewn with papers, a new manuscript he is working on. I don't try to make out any words, but a large black Bible is open to Thessalonians. He squeezes me, pressing my breasts against his chest. He likes women with big breasts, which I guess I have. I'm still not in tune with my body, but people say I have a nice figure. Even the doctor said so when I was 16, when he taught Christian Family and Sex Camp. He said I had a figure men would like. Take a looky at these, he says. He releases me with a brisk pat on my back and points to a large flat box on his bed. Go ahead, open it. I wipe my eyes and go and walk over to his bed. The sheets are pulled half back in a neat triangle. I open the black box. Inside is a bed of blue velvet. Inside on a bed of blue velvet are about 20 different silver and turquoise rings. Aren't they beautiful? A believer in New Mexico made them all. They're pure 100% sterling. He smiles again. His teeth are very white. I nod. Depression has replaced the adrenaline of getting here, and I'm crashing fast. I don't know what to say. I don't care about the rings. I don't care about living. Save me, doctor, please, I'm falling. He stands, crosses over to me, and sits down in the bed beside me. His robe slips open and reveals his bare legs. I move over to make room for him. He grabs the box from me and picks out a silver band with turquoise stones inlaid. What do you think of this one? He pulls out a ring with a turquoise dove. He smiles again, seeming oblivious to my mood. If he senses any distress, he chooses to ignore it. He's trying to distract me, make me feel better. That's what it is. It's nice, I say. Well, you can have it if you want, or you can pick out one yourself. Here's another nice one. Here, I think you should have this one. He picks out a delicate ring with two hummingbirds beak to beak. How do you like this one? Looks like they're kissing, don't it? Kissing cousins. I nod again. A tear falls on the blanket. Then another and another. I wipe my cheeks. Now, honey, he says, replacing the ring and closing the box. He places the box on the ledge behind us. Why don't you tell me what's on your heart? We can talk about this later. What brought you all the way down here from Cheyenne that was so important? I shake my head. I feel like I can't. Like what? Speak up a little. He places his arm behind me and leans in closer. I can't do this anymore, I say, and I start to cry. My shoulders shake, and he puts his arm around me. You can't do what anymore, honey? Talk to me. Live, I can't live, I blurt out. What's this talk, you can't live? Now tell old VP what's happening. It's my marriage, I say, sobbing. What about your marriage? Now slow down, catch your breath. That's better. Now go ahead. He rubs my back, pushes the hair out of my eyes. Remember how I told you that Alec hit me? He nods. I remember. Has that gotten any better? No, it's gotten worse. Now we fight all the time. Oh, no, honey. I drop my head into my hands and start sobbing again. Just the sound of his voice, the compassion in it, like Jesus would have said. Oh, no, honey. I'm so screwed up. I've made a mess of everything. I've really blown it. I think I'm better off dead. I keep thinking about it. I shouldn't be alive anymore. I've made too many mistakes. It's gotten so bad between us now. Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute, the doctor holds up his hand. You can't be talking like that. That's a devil spirit in you, honey. You've got to stop. But that's how I feel. I want to die. The room is dark. Someone's turned off the light, so the sun has gone down. The room starts to spin around me. I'm possessed. I have a devil spirit in me that's making me think of suicide. The doctor will get rid of it, just like Jesus did. He'll cast it out and I'll be fine. I'll go back to my husband. I'll say goodbye to Jeff. That's another story there.
Right.
if you keep talking that way, he says, we won't have any more times like we used to. You hear me? Now, you've got to stop talking like this. Understand? It's just devilish. There's an edge in his voice, not of irritation, but of worry, as though he doesn't know what to do. The wizard's curtain has been pulled. He kisses me. His tongue fills my mouth and invades me, fills the hollow space inside. But nothing is filling it. I'm possessed. I have to stop thinking this way. He won't want to see me anymore. Take your clothes off. I'll show you what's good about being alive.